And welcome back, or welcome to the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, Jonathan Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
We're back to give the people what they want, Steven. Let's go! You guys know how we do, and we do it big.
That's right. And today we've got, you know, a topic I'm looking forward to jumping into. Medium dig cycle, when and why to purposely dig a hole in training. We've recently covered overtraining, right? And knowing when you go. And now we're saying, wait, go dig that hole? Like, go put yourself in the hole and see what happens? What are you guys talking about, you might think? Well, this episode, we're going to explore those times where we just got to go. And
I have one question for the audience. If you are not a Running Scholar member, why? If you've been listening to this podcast for a sustained period of time and you have not joined it, why? And honestly, you cannot say the cost because it's about $1, you know, and a couple pennies a day. So why? Why have you not joined over 800 of your fellow peers in coaching and running? Why are you not a part of the continual conversation that's always chirping, especially extra active here in the clubhouse as we get ready for the outdoor track season for high school and college? Why are you not contributing to conversation? Why are you not learning and leveling yourself up and making yourself a better coach? I just got my USTF CCCCCA Sprint Hurdle Relay certification and, you know, adding a new dimension to my coaching toolbox. And next year is going to be the throw certification. Watch out, Steve. I'm going to be this generation's Tom Selez, coaching everything and everything. This is to say, I am not only the president, I also use it, as in the old Rogaine commercials. So continuing education is so vital in any profession. And that's the only way to get better is by being constantly challenged, by being constantly exposed to new things. And the only place you can do that in the world for running and distance running and training and coaching on a regular basis is the Running Scholar Clubhouse and the Running Scholar Program. If you're not signed up, I don't know what you're waiting for.
That's the
pitch. It's not getting any cheaper. So lock it in now.
That's the pitch, man. I couldn't agree more. And you know, the thing about it is we've been doing this for several years and every week you get new information. I mean, we're talking about, I don't even know how long, 4 years, 5 years, something like that. Every week for those years, new information. Why? Because John and I are learners. We're trying, as John just said, you know, learn about the shot put, throws, let's go. But what we try and do is pass on that information, not only from ourselves, but other world-class coaches. As you probably know, we have an entire section on Canova. Why? Because he was generous enough to take the time and give us a ton of information and behind-the-scenes stuff. Because he said, you know what, you guys are doing is great. You're spreading the information, being the repository. We're essentially trying to be this generation's Fred Will.
Amen. Yes, he is the inspiration. Well, for the people.
And for the people.
The people have access to any and all information. This is why Steve and I buy these rare-ass books from, you know, the 1950s. We're like, oh, there's only one copy of that in existence, but it has two chapters on Igloi. Okay, great. Boom, that dropped $150.
That's right. The Igloi course
is for y'all.
Igloi course is essentially a dive into obscurity, both foreign languages, thanks to good friends who helped us translate that or find and translate that, but also obscure books, you know, interviews, all sorts of stuff. It's the perfect example of what you get is gold that is out there, but man, you got to work to find it. John and I do the digging.
Wait, sign up now, because you know what, every month you wait, every year you wait, every season you wait, it's just more and more information to dig through, right? So like, you gotta jump in the stream and start floating down the river now, so that when you get to the rapids or there's this new dump of information or a waterfall coming through with a new course or something, you can pick it up mid-stride. Because that's often, you know, everyone's first reaction to entering the clubhouse is like, there's just so much information, so much, you know, or the program is like, I don't even know where to start. And very simply, you start where you want to start, right? It's self-guided learning, exploration. You start where you want to start. You start where you have questions. And as you grow as a coach and as you grow as a runner, you'll have different questions. You'll have, you know, more unique questions, more specific questions. And boom, we got it covered. It's in there somewhere, guaranteed.
There we go. So check it out now. Don't delay. All right, into this week's topic, medium dig cycle. All right, John, I'm going to turn it over to you because people might, if you've been a loyal listener to this podcast, you probably heard the word or the phrase medium dig cycle before. We've talked about it. But John, for all of us, why don't you define what that is and give us the backstory on where you heard about this first?
Yeah, medium dig cycles came from my good friend and mentor, Jerry Schumacher. And I remember being a young coach, right? And hearing about supercompensation, the hard, easy approach, blah, 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 all this stuff. And then 1 week before, you know, about a month before, at that time, it was called the Oxy High Performance Meet. It's now called the USATF Middle Distance Classic. Jerry had his cohort of guys, before it was Bowerman, just called Jerry's guys, do something really interesting in training. They ran kind of three really moderate workouts on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then a structured long run on a Sunday. So essentially in a 7-day cycle, four kind of hard ass sessions, but not anyone was too mega big hit hard. They were all just kind of hard in a different way, right? One time it was, you know, one session was repeat quarters. Another session was 400, 200, 200, as he called it, forever. Another session was just really, really fast, 200 hills, 200 on the track, 200 hills, and then kind of the medium long run. Structured medium long run. And I was like, why are you subjecting world-class athletes? This seems like a crazy person thing. This seems like only someone who is like, you know, people who are on the most amount of recovery steroids and drugs in the world would do, which, you know, it's not Jerry's MO at all. And, you know, I asked him, he goes, this is the icing on the cake. This is what's going to get us over the hump. And it's going to put us at Mount Everest level fitness. And it was after, like, you know, the guys came back from this big block of altitude training, right? So there's a certain conditions that surround this. But when you think about it, it was just like this kind of this final purposeful push of embarrassing the body through very strategic, moderate workloads for a small density of time in order to get them better. And, you know, then I asked him, well, what do you do next the week after? He goes, oh yeah, we take it easy for like 5-6 days after this. Like easy, 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 you know. And that to me, it, you know, I was like, wow, this is wild. I never even thought this would be a thing. And what I did was I did what anyone in the clubhouse and Steve and I have done is I just experimented. I did it first, experimented on myself. And then I started experimenting with athletes who were strong enough, fit enough, and capable enough and ready. And you know what? It freaking worked. And it freaking worked really well. Like the magnitude of stimulus and adaptation from that was like something else. Like I never saw it. However, the caveat is it has to come at a certain time in an athlete's training when they're robust enough, strong enough, mature enough, resilient enough to handle that type of workload and density of workload to get the intended stimulus. But it's one of those things where it's like, yes, purposefully, strategically, like a surgeon, only maybe once in a training block, once in a season, or once in the preparation for a season, do we do this. But man, when we do this, watch out in 2 to 3 weeks, because all of a sudden it's this like, phenomenal jump in ability, phenomenal jump in fitness, phenomenal jump in toughness. And the only reason we talk about it, right, is because it works. And I've tried it not only on professionals, I've tried it on college level runners. I've tried it on high school level runners. And it's just one of those things where if you know what you're doing and you're able to walk that line and dance that dance, wow, you can really accelerate fitness for an athlete before they get into an important phase of competition.
You know, I love this. And it's, again, something that I had to learn just like you did, because I think traditionally we think of getting better super compensation as a workout to workout thing where we apply the stress, we let them recover enough, and then apply another stress. And it's,
we think
it's,
about it on a day-to-day basis.
Yes.
Right?
It's hard,
it's a micro time horizons. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Micro time horizons. And what Jerry is showing here is we got to zoom out sometimes, right? And be like, let's expand the time horizon. Instead of seeing it hard, easy, whatever it is, we've got to say, hey, we're going to dig a little bit deeper for this period and then give them extended time to kind of get out of this and super
still hard, easy, but more of a macro scale, right?
Right, exactly. And the way I like to compare it to is actually taking it outside of the world of training and running and look at it from a perspective of like happiness. So if we look at the research on happiness, it's mostly like what you do on the day to day. It's the small things, right? Do you see friends and family? Do you have outlets? Do you have like some meaning in the work that you do? All of that stuff, which is like the day to day stuff. But every once in a while, you've got to do something to kind of like disrupt that pattern, meaning like go on a fun date, like do something exciting, like go on a vacation. And if in those vacations, those things, like they're almost like disruptors where it's like, hey, there's the big thing that like levels us up a little bit more. And I think that analogy of most of the training is the day to day of like, we just want small bites. We're not trying to win the lottery every day. If we did, we wouldn't be any happier, as research shows, because like you just adapt. What we're trying to do is day-to-day, gradual improvement. But every once in a while, we've got to like disrupt the system. We've got to do what I'd call as like a perspective changer. I almost see it as like the body gets in a kind of steady state of like, this is predictable. I'm going to do these 400s or these 800s, and I'm going to have a day or two to recover, and then I'm going to do this. And you know the cycle. And there's a lot of good stuff in that predictability. But as we know with anything, in that predictability, like that adaptation, the mountain you're adapting from stuff, like kind of goes down every once in a while, or goes down, right? Because we adapt to the stressor. It's no different than what we talked about in episode one, clean slate phenomenon. Why do newcomers adapt to everything? Because everything is new. So, but when we look at elite athletes or even highly trained athletes, you know, what's happened is we've become used to the, you know, two workouts in the long run pattern. And what Jerry is doing here is saying, okay, hey, body, time out. I'm going to throw you for a little bit of a loop. Not too much of a loop so that we can't like get out of this hole, but I'm going to throw you for a loop and this is going to force you to kind of your body go, oh crap. Like I didn't predict this. Scramble the resources. Like we've got to adjust, but it's not so much that you scramble the resources and you realize, I don't have the fuel to adjust to this. I don't have the resources to adjust. It's just that sweet spot of like, let's disrupt the system. Let's remind the body that, hey, we have to, you know, not everything is predictable. We've got to be able to adapt in a new way.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's also comes with a lot of like caveats about who to apply this to, right? You can't apply this to an athlete who is not physically prepared, who doesn't have a certain amount of training, consistent training behind them, whose training aid is very young. Right. This is a more sophisticated, more kind of like advanced upper level adaptation or training strategy that is for an athlete who has put in a good amount of foundational work, that where this recourse of training is kind of the last bit of the icing on the cake to push the ceiling, so to speak, of ability when right before you enter in to a period of kind of steady racing or big races where you just want to get that extra bump in fitness. So it's not something, you know, we are saying, hey, try this with everybody and anybody. I mean, it's again, people higher training age, stronger athletes and athletes who, again, are ready for this you know, density of severity or density of work that can respond to, because it's a fine line between, you know, creating embarrassment in the body that spurs adaptation and spurs a positive reaction response versus overtraining, getting someone fatigued and, you know, having it, you know, cause them to get sick or hurt.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing I'd like to point out here is that other really good coaches do this stuff. We talked about Canova in the beginning. What does Canova do? He doesn't call it a medium dig cycle, but he calls it a special block, right? What is a Canova special block? A period of time where they're essentially digging a bigger hole through sometimes double workouts, sometimes back-to-back workouts, sometimes workouts spaced within, you know, a short period of time, more so than he normally would. And what does he say? If you read through in the Running Scholar program, you'll see this. He said, you know, one of the most important things, I'm paraphrasing here, one of the most important things is to make sure you have good recovery going in and then good recovery going out. Like, the recovery has to be commensurate to the stress applied. So similar to Jerry, like, the couple days, the few days afterwards are super easy for Canova when he does these special block trainings. Why does he do them? For the same reason that Jerry does, is like, you have to almost say, hey, here's a big stressor. Like, let's see if we can adapt to this in a better direction. And the key, as you said, John, is like, I think, you know, hopefully listeners get the idea, but it's the robustness of the individual, where they are coming in. So if they're coming in already really fatigued and you try and throw this on top, it's not going to work, right? You've got to do it at a time where, yeah, they're maybe a little fatigued, they're coming in, but there's training, all that stuff, but like, they have the resources to adapt. And the other part of it is, again, like, the timing and the recovery after. Like Canova said it, like, the rest has to be commensurate to the stress. So you've got to make sure that, you know, afterwards, you don't just jump straight back into your two workouts and hot, you know, in a long run cycle that you did and just say, hey, we'll plug and play here. We've got to adapt to the thing that we did. And then the last part, as you mentioned, but I think is really critical, is the timing in the season. This is, as Jerry said, as you quoted Jerry, the icing on the cake. But it's, how do you time it? And to me, I always thought of it as, or applying this, where do I have this so that I get that boost in adaptation before the races that I want, but I'm not too close to the races so that the adaptation cycle hasn't taken place, or the fatigue, if we look at a fitness and fatigue model, the fatigue hasn't dissipated enough where I can express the fitness that I adapted to.
Yeah, I mean, let's piggyback on that last point. The fatigue that is incurred when doing this, even with a really fit athlete, is severe. It's pretty high. So, you know, I'll give a couple different specific examples of, you know, applying this successfully from my own coaching, both current and past. So with, say, like pro or post-collegiate runners who might go and spend a month at altitude, right? The whole idea of spending 1 month at altitude is you go up, you get kind of like the boost in natural EPO synthesis, red blood cell count, all that stuff goes up, right? So because all that stuff goes up, it's your ability to recover has now been augmented. So you can do this, you can recover from stimulus, you get more flushing out of toxins of the body, you get better oxygen delivery to the cells, blah, 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 blah. So when you come down from altitude, this, you have about roughly 4 to 6 weeks where your body is in this primed physiological state. If you've done your altitude training right, if you've done everything right for that month, where you can rip and roll, so to speak, and you can get a lot better because your recovery capacity has been increased. So typically what it is, right, is we know there's time horizons post-altitude where people fall a little flat because of the change in the environment when you go up to altitude, back down to sea level. So for some people, that's 3 days. For some people, that's 2 weeks. It really depends, right? But in that time, immediately following, say, altitude, you then have an opportunity within a week to rip and roll. so to speak, or do a medium dig cycle. And the medium dig cycles, you know, kind of are predecessors to double lactate or double threshold days, right? But it's stacking moderate days of either discrete or complementary stimuli in a back-to-back fashion, where it's like every 48 hours, you hit the body with something a little bit different. Or you can also do, you know, depending on if you're going to have a long run or not, or if you can also go back-to-back days with a day or two in between, right? So you can go day one, day two, you know, rest up, day one, day two, rest up, out of the medium dig cycle, or every other day. I've done both, and both work. You just have to understand who you're primarily dealing with. Is it more of an endurance athlete, like 5K, 10K and up, where you want to go every other day and end with a kind of that structured long run, or your fatigue to really create that final embarrassment, or, you know, really heavy impulse for adaptation? Or if you have middle distance athletes, it's probably going to be more back-to-back days with a day in between, a back-to-back day, and then, you know, taking longer rest. Why? It's not just, again, peripheral fatigue that happens with the muscle tissues, the physiological system. There's also a amount of neural or central fatigue that you have to accommodate for. So what usually happens, right, is the first half of a medium dig cycle, athletes are coming in a little fresh. You've given them a little bit of time to relax, like maybe a day off, maybe some light running or light activity for a day or two, right? So you purposely have kind of like lightened the load on a acute level. 24 or 48 to 72 hours leading in to this, you know, the glycogen stores are stocked, right? They've eaten a whole bunch, right? There has not been a heavy depletion on the system. So now what you're doing is you're purposely depleting the system, right? And you're not giving it a chance to catch back up, right? So over the course of this week, glycogen stores will decline. And they, even if they're eating a crap ton, you got to emphasize, you got to eat a lot. You will not get full resynthesis within this week just because of the severity that the body is being subject to. And as a coach, you have to be on guard and aware of what low glycogen levels look like, especially in the second half of the week, right? Does the athlete have like a long face? Is their mood kind of down in the dumps? You know, do they have a little bit of like brain fog? Like, you know, they're just not like crisp, or it's everything's so exponentially harder, right? That is a symptom of, you know, acute glycogen depletion. And that's par for the course and part of it, because part of what we're doing is trying to spur, you know, this glycogen supercompensation effect in the tissues by asking it to work under severe demand or load. But, you know, like this week is a good example. I'm having the Portland State middle distance runners go through a medium dig cycle, right? Where it's like, okay, a moderate session on a Monday, and then a moderate session on a Tuesday, easy relaxed running or cross training on a Wednesday, another moderate session with Russian intervals that we just talked about on a Thursday, and then today will be the final moderate session of kind of some flux style work on the track, 300s at 3K effort, 100 meter float, if you will, for 1 mile, 3 to 4 times that, off day, then 3 or 4 off days, right? And what's happening, right, yesterday, talking with an athlete is, you know, they were like, they did the Russian interval and everything, and they were just like, coach, I just feel off, I feel drained, I'm eating a lot, I'm sleeping a lot, I'm hydrating a lot, you know, the face is really long. Like, I was like, hey, how's, you know, how is your brain crisp, or you feel like you're kind of fuzzy or in a fog? They're like, yep, I'm like that, right? And so this athlete, being a younger athlete, collegiate athlete, being exposed to this, I was like, great, you're done, you're at the end of the dig, I want you to take Friday off, you're not doing the flux session, right? Because we took them right to the edge, right to the line. And that's the hardest part, is like, you have to be in constant communication with your athletes, because you want to take them right to the edge, but not have them fall off the cliff. And when they start to express these things, or someone who just like wants to train, wants to get better, a normal athlete who's like excited and motivated to get to work is, you know, kind of going through the motions, so to speak, or a little more lackadaisical, or just feeling blah, the body's brain's going to go into survival mode and prioritize not doing work because it understands glycogen stores are, you know, low, and this work and activity will make it lower. So it's going to purposely like back it off, you know, through mood. And when you see that mood alteration in a highly motivated athlete who really wants to get to work and they're just kind of like, you know, dragging, so to speak, and not their normal like motivated self, that's a signal of, you know, making adjustments as well. So the important thing also is this is to say, you don't necessarily need to be wedded to having to do all the density of work. As you get to the end of the cycle, the end of the week, you have to really be in constant communication and get that, you know, real-time feedback with your athletes to figure out if more work is going to be of value or if it's going to move them from a medium dig to potentially an overtraining situation.
Yeah, it really is taking into consideration the holistic part of what you're looking at. And I think that's what, you know, we're talking about here. And that's what you're getting at is kind of zooming out and seeing the macro is like most of the time we think, are they recovered from this session? And instead, we're looking at holistically zooming out. How are we manipulating fatigue and the stress to make sure that we're digging the hole to the right amount, but not so much that we can't bounce back out of it. And you're looking for those signs and symptoms you talked about from a glycogen depletion side. And I often see this in through like an Igloi lens when I've used these kind of cycles, these macro kind of dig cycles in the past, is I might have a plan of what the workout should be, but what I really need to do, especially after you get through the first medium workout and you're on the second or third one, is pay attention and observe and look at how are the athletes warming up? How do the athletes look during the first or second or third interval? And really go step by step to see like, is this athlete in a good place still where, yeah, they're showing fatigue, but they can still handle it. They can still get through it. We're not going to the depths of a hole so large that we can't get out of it, because it's really that balancing point. So as a coach, if you say, hey, I listen to John and Steve, I want to try this cycle, you have to be the coach who is observant and aware, not the coach who is just sitting there saying, hey, I'm holding the stopwatch and you're going to do the workout as written no matter what. And I think that's the key. In actuality, I mentioned Igloi. If you go to the Igloi course in the Scholar Program, you'll see where Igloi, way back in the day, would strategically, you know, have cycles in his training where, for instance, he would do a hard workout the day after a race. Why? Because, you know, in his words, he wasn't saying medium dig cycle, stress and adaptation, supercompensation. No, what he was saying is saying, hey, like at some point, we're going to go into a competition or to get you ready for this competition. We know that you're going to have to run prelims and finals and have several stresses in a row. So we're going to deviate from the normal, you know, stress and recovery cycle that we, you know, that he used and say, hey, we're going to race. And the next day we're going to do another hard workout so that we get you prepared for what you're going to have to face. And now if we looked at it from a physiological standpoint, we know that what he's doing there is essentially the same thing, overloading the system in a manageable, you know, in a meaningful way that is manageable so that he can kind of boost the training and fitness. And that's all we're looking at here. But I would encourage listeners to think of, you know, especially during these cycles, is you have to become more aware. You've got to look for the signs and symptoms. You've got to look for the mood changes. You've got to look for the pop, the bounciness, the responsiveness changes, and you know, decide when you're going too far, need to pull back, or if you're in a good spot and can continue down this path.
Yeah. And, you know, then you also have to think about sequencing the load, sequencing the work, right? And there's a lot of different modalities you can use to do this. So I'll give an example again, because we're living this and going through this right now in real time with the Portland State Middle Distance Runners, is the sequencing of load. Essentially what you want to do is something is start off in the beginning with the highest neural demand when you're freshest, right? Because you can't do speed when you're fatigued. You can't get faster when you're tired. And we're not just talking about the context of one training session, but also globally throughout the course of a week. So at the tail end of a medium dig cycle, doesn't make sense to try to run fast because the nervous central fatigue is, you know, crept up with the nervous system. Peripheral fatigue is constant with lower glycogen levels. So in order to do that, you start off with the highest neural work first. So what this looks like in practice is, as an example, is day one here on Monday was stairs and hills, right? So we're doing 20-second stairs and hill sprints, right? So really rapid turnover on the stair sprints, same thing on the hill sprints, full walk down recovery. And, you know, you're doing a package of stairs or hills and stairs, hills for 6 times each, right? Full recovery in between all of that stuff so that, you know, they are able to produce the highest neural output possible. Okay. Then coming back in the weight room with kind of more of a general weight room training activity, a little bit of mobility, a little bit of medicine ball work, a little bit of core stuff. So 2 days, right? Or 1 day, we have two different times of this high neural load. And then when you're acutely fatigued, a little bit more kind of general strength work. Nothing too wild and crazy. Then day two, right, is going to be 1K breakdowns. So 1K breakdowns in the context of 500, 300, 200. And this is for middle distance, 815 type athletes, right? Where we are then doing, okay, the 500 is going to be at, you know, a pace around their mile pace. The 300 is going to be a pace at around their 800 pace. And the 200 is going to be a pace at around, not at like 600 meter pace, right? Not as fast as a four pace, but not as, but a little faster than 800 pace. So we're doing anywhere from, depending on the maturity of the athlete, 3 to 5 sets of that, right? So 3 to 5 times a K with 2 minutes rest in between, like rest. You can walk, you can stand, you don't need to jog. You can jog, you can shake it out a little bit. So boom, boom, boom. And then a Bulgarian lift following that, where a Bulgarian lift is you pick out of all the lifting packages, one exercise, in this case, trap bar deadlift or hex bar deadlift. And you use the kind of like daily min to daily max and drop back method, right? Where you strategically over the course of, you know, 3 to 4 sets, increase the load that you're lifting. And then you drop back for 3 sets of 5 of kind of a moderate in between load, right? So you start at a daily minimum, you work yourself up to a daily maximum, you drop back, you finish with volume at that. That's a post-activation potentiation activity. So when you try to lift that heavier weight or the daily max, and you drop back to lift the lighter weight relative to the daily max, it feels easier, quote unquote, but you're still getting really high quality of work because it's relatively heavier than what you started off with. You're fried after that. You're fried. FYI, they're fried. So how to acutely create restoration? Tell them eat a lot, sleep a lot, hydrate a lot. The next day is, depending on who they are and what they respond to, easy cross training for 60 minutes, easy shakeout run for 30 minutes, you know, kind of maybe a medium run if they're more of an endurance inclined middle distance runner and have lower sensitivity to that of 60 minutes. Easy. Emphasis on the easy. Just shake it out. Oxidative recovery. No big deal, right? Then they come back on Thursday, and most people are in better spirits, right? Okay, great. Whew. Yeah, coach, still a little sore. You know, still a little tired. Okay, great. So then Russian intervals. So what was Russian intervals? Russian intervals are pretty simple, right? It was 2 sets of a medicine ball type activity for about 20 to 30 seconds, and then 1 lap at, and this is for guys, middle distance guys, 1 lap at 75 seconds. And we're doing 2 sets of 5 rounds. So they're running 2 kilometers total at 75, but it's interspersed with about 30 seconds of medicine ball work, right? So we're doing overhead medicine ball slams on the track, right? And then boom, blow the whistle, they run a lap, come right back. All right, now we're doing, you know, rotational medicine ball slams on the track, or rotational medicine ball slams against the cement wall that's right next to the track. Do that for 30 seconds, blow the whistle. And so continuously you're moving for about 10 minutes, right? What do we know that is an important, you know, stimulus for 10 minutes? Oh, tempo runs, right? Or this mitochondrial or aerobic hit of something doing something continuous for 10 minutes starts to spur that enzymatic release. And if you do it for 20 minutes, we know that's the minimum amount for really pronounced mitochondrial biogenesis or enzymatic pathway. So guess what? Two times this circuit, right? So that's two times 10 minutes. Take about 5 minutes flat rest. What happens though is the athletes are like, wow, I recovered really quick in between that. Coach, I didn't need 5 minutes for my aerobic system or my breath and my heart rate to go down. It was after about 3 minutes. But let me tell you, the first 90 seconds, 2 minutes, they're like on the ground praying to their maker, because after they get done, they're like, what just happened? The nervous system is sent sideways. The aerobic system has a really high demand. Like you're doing, so, you know, and you don't have to do med balls. You can also do like jumping drills in place, or, you know, push-ups, or just something that's a general strength activity that puts a different neuromuscular task or load on the body for 20 to 30 seconds. But again, you know, and then you give the brain an acute period of restoration and they're able to bounce back, right? Really quickly. Back in the weight room on Thursday, again, with the Bulgarian lifting method, still just like nothing new, no movement patterns, just, hey, all I want you to do is just have a heavier daily max. That's all we got to do. So we get some general strength in there, some lifts. And then today, Friday, is the end of the cycle. So it's the last load of work. And what they're doing is a flux style workout where it's pretty simple. And the construction of the flux is going to be 3 to 4 by a mile as 300 meters at 3K pace with 100 meter float kind of at a steady tempo. Like steady is here for the guys is about 620 pace for the, you know, for the 100 meters. So 3K pace, 620 pace, 3K pace, 620 pace for 1 mile back and forth like that. 3 minutes rest in between. That's it. We're done. Medium dig cycle over. And again, when you look at this, what you see, right, is in the beginning of the week, high neural load, high, faster stuff, right? Stuff that's really more challenging, cut downs, stairs and hills, two lifts back to back. At the end of the week, mitochondrial stuff or aerobic stuff, if you will, right? Rush intervals to get the mitochondrial release hit, boom, day one. Flux workout the next day in a very manageable package to get to just keep it real high and bump you up. So understanding in thematically from a medium dig cycle, you want to prioritize the neural stuff early in the week and the mitochondrial or aerobic stuff later in the week, because that's going to create the appropriate sequencing that will spur the adaptation you want. And they will be good and tired and basically, you know, pretty fried for about 5 days. And then you then appropriate training accordingly. Day off, cross training, maybe for the speed power people, some lighter, faster strides, like 100 meters, just feel good 100 meters with as much recovery as you need, not a lot of volume of work, and just basically waiting and taking their time for them to get their glycogen stores back up and their body to absorb this demanding task.
You know, it reminds me of something that Konova said, which is essentially during his special blocks, is you need to go in the other direction. And I think that's what you're getting at. And what he would say, and I've used this as well, is generally when I do stuff, I call it like fast first, and then add in the, or then top that off with kind of the longer threshold stuff. So to give you an example, is we might do something like 200s or 300s or something 400, something like that, like early in the week. Where sometimes, again, depending on it, if we're going for a speed, more of a neural and long rest, if we're going for maybe a higher like anaerobic component, we might do short rest and so, you know, get some lactate production by doing, you know, 400s at mile pace or what have you. But then we come back and we go the other direction, which is some, you know, old school style Daniels Cruz intervals or some split thresholds or whatever have you. And I love this, again, for the same reason, the sequencing effect. But what you're getting here is you're essentially, especially when you're talking track athletes, we're hitting something that is more specific that might cause, you know, a little bit more of this kind of combination of like neural fatigue plus metabolic fatigue. And then we come off of it and we go a different direction where we're getting that aerobic stimulus, which still is under fatigue, but has a way of counterbalancing out kind of that speed. If we looked at the kind of seesaw of speed and endurance, we hit the anaerobic stuff, we tilt ourselves into that specific speed endurance stuff, and then we come back and we go the other direction to kind of balance that out, so we get this kind of nice synergistic effect. Is I'm a huge fan of that. And that could be, again, as John stated here, spread over two or three workouts in a week. Or it could be, and what we saw sometimes with Canova special blocks is a morning, one of the things I would often do is if I was doing a Canova special block is morning 200s, you know, whatever, 16, 20 by 200, 200 meter jog, working down from mile pace, going faster. And then in the afternoon, doing a split threshold. Because what you're doing is you're getting this kind of synergistic effect here. Nova would call it go in the other direction. Now, there are times. Now, let's talk about the elephant in the room. There are times when you might want to go in the same direction. This is the basis of the double threshold workouts. But this is like a topping off of one system. And I've done this before for medium big cycles, special blocks, whatever have you. But it's, to me, it's used in a different period. So for example, we've mainly been talking about, hey, this is the icing on your cake, right? This is, you know, several weeks, month out, whatever it is from the big race that you're getting ready for to prepare you for it. The double threshold to me is a topping up of the aerobic system. It is when you have developed aerobically, you've gone through your base or pre-competition phase and you're hit the aerobic system and you're saying, hey, I'm going to top this up. But you have to acknowledge that when you do that, you're shifting the balance because you don't have that speed or speed endurance or whatever to kind of hold that seesaw in balance, right? And that's okay at this point because you're doing it early enough to realize that, hey, I'm going to come back later and, you know, balance this thing out. Essentially, it's the old school like Lydiard approach. What do? You do a large block of endurance work, you know, maintain a little bit of speed before you shift emphasis in old school Lydiard where you're doing 5 days a week, 6 days a week of intervals. You know, more modern linear, 3 days a week of intervals, where you're saying, okay, I built this huge aerobic block. Now I'm going to shift this balance and bring the stuff that I kind of neglected a little bit. So that double threshold to me is used when you're saying, hey, I'm at a point where I'm going to top this thing off. So to give you an example, if you're entering the cross country season or at the beginning stages of the cross country season, and you're saying, I'm going to top off this threshold before I transition to my, we'll say, specific phase where I'm getting ready for the high school 5K or the college 8K and 10K, right? You're topping things off. You're adding that stimulus all in the same direction, saying like, we're just going to push it just a little bit more so that we adapt. And then I know, hey, I'm gonna balance this out later on the macro style. I'm going to sacrifice a little of the speed, but I'm going to bring it back around, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a tough dance, right? It's we typically, a lot of times what happens, right, is you have to understand in the running training media world, some athlete comes through who has a novel or, you know, not common approach to training and they quote unquote shock the world and they're running, you know, really fast at world record or near world record speeds or winning things. Right. And then what the average person does and the average coach with the average athlete says, oh, I'm going to mimic and mirror this stuff in my training because this person's the best in the world and this is what they're doing and they're good. So it will work for me. And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Time out, Jeans. Are you at the same point in your maturation of training? Are you at the same level of strength, speed? Is this what you need really to get you over the hump? And a lot of times, right, it's not. A lot of times it's just, you just need to get more consistent. You need to go to the weight room 3 times a week. You know, show up every day to like practice on time, right? It's very simple things like that. You need to not make excuses and get out of bed and, you know, do the little things so you feel good and you recover, right? And we have to remember these exotic or, you know, methods of training, a lot of times, like we're talking about, is the icing on the cake and done right before a period of very frequent competition, right? So we're doing this at the end of, in middle of February, right? Right before the start of the outdoor season. Because guess what? For the roster I have, basically there's a meet on offer every single weekend throughout March and April for them to compete, for them to get at, right? And so we will refine our racing capacity, our racing ability, the strategy of racing in those meets, but we won't get fitter. We will be as fit as we will be start of March. And all that will do is we will get faster because we either had a better racing strategy or we're more recovered or what have you. And we'll maintain fitness. We'll maintain that mitochondrial density throughout the season, but it's unrealistic to try to, one, concurrently get better, do harder, higher, you know, more dense workloads of training during a track season when we're asking people to race, especially with middle distance, as you need to with high frequency, right? The 800 meter runner we know has to race multiple all out 800s. And that's the most specific way to increase their acidosis tolerance, right? So that they're able to tolerate or buffer a certain amount of acidosis in the system for a discrete period of time during a race. You know, we're building their mitochondrial capacity to hopefully allow for a high level of acidosis clearance ability where they can actually clear that kind of quote unquote lactate or the, you know, acidic byproducts that are associated with lactate expression from their system during the race. But tolerance, right, is a much more difficult task. And the best way to do that for middle distance runners is in the most specific venue possible, intermediate races.
Absolutely. No, I think this is, again, where the timing, if I could sum everything up in this, you know, what we're looking at is these are your boosters. These are like the jet fuel to boost something, right? When you look at these cycles, you have to decide, what am I trying to boost? Sometimes that might be the aerobic system. Sometimes that might be general fitness. Sometimes that might be all aspects of the gamut of fitness that applies to us, right? Race-specific fitness. What you're trying to boost influences the timing. And then we zoom out and we say, okay, at what period of time do I need to do this thing? Right. And you take it holistically. So, for example, you know, when we would often do some of these boosting things as well, John, is when I was working with professional athletes, whenever we would go to that European summer, because you knew they were going to race a lot and you knew that the training time was going to be less. The training input was going to be less because you're over in Europe doing kind of the B circuit where you're traveling and you get in races last minute. And, you know, I remember I had one athlete get a world standard because they got an invite to race, you know, 2 days before the race. So the kind of schedule of like flow gets out. So often going into this, what would we do? We'd say, hey, we're going to go through one of these cycles to just give us this boost because we know that training is going to be a little all over the place for a little bit. So you time it appropriately for this. And college athletes, I would often, you know, do this before we'd hit this long period of racing during an indoor stretch or during outdoor stretch or what have you. Is the timing is really important on this stuff. And then the other thing that I think, again, if coaches are listening and wanting to apply this, is the most important thing is like what you're doing going in and going out of it. Is, are you giving them the rest to be able to adapt, or are you throwing more fuel into the flame and that flame's just going to burn and then burn out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's, if you're not sure how to do it successfully, don't do it. Because it's just one of those things. It's such a fine line to walk. And you, if you've seen it, if you've seen how, like, the most important thing is, like, either you have to do it yourself or be willing to experiment with athletes if you've never done it before, up for the task and ready for the task. And then two, it's more like I said, managing people's reactions, like emotional, physical feedback reactions, especially at the tail end of it, on the second half of it, which is the art of coaching, right? That is, it's so tough because everyone's reaction might be different. And you might've thought an athlete is up for the challenge and task of that density of workload. And you then all of a sudden, like I talked about with one young man, it was very clear. We got to day 3 of 4 of the medium dig cycle and he was cashed out. So it's like, great, you're over. And, you know, like any good athlete, say, oh, I want to do some work tomorrow, coach. Like, no, there's no point. Like, just trust coach on this one. Like, that we were here to get you better, not get you tired type situation. And if you don't have that coach's eye or that confidence and that mastery and to see the physical body language signs that are expressing this, you know, place of chronic acute glycogen depletion or lack of, you know, resynthesis or just general fatigue, don't do it. Try it, talk to people about it. You know, remember, we always encourage experimenters' mindset and experimenters' approach to coaching and explore and discover, but also to be intelligent with when and where and who you're doing that with. If this is your first time exploring this type of construction,
there you go. So coaches, be an explorer. If you want to talk about this, if you want to experiment on medium dig cycles, special blocks, like, you know, the best way to learn is to go to the clubhouse, talk to other coaches, talk to those who have tried things, because that will save you a lot of headache on experimenting in the right wrong direction or not having lessons learned. And the best way to up that education is to learn from others, not just what John and I put out, but the hundreds upon hundreds of other coaches who are in the clubhouse or in the monthly, you know, Zoom meetings that John and I host with some wonderful high school, college, and professional coaches that, you know, digs into these topics and asks not just us, but asks advice and on people's experience. So if you want to learn more, that's where it's at. Don't wait. Check it out today.